image of whatever they have been the inside of the patient having it. So is actually do you see like a picture like photograph that you draft? Okay. And then usually this is being done this way that that radiation, which is a very weak radiation, is going to explore collimator. Collimator is nothing but a honeybee, something that has thousands of cohorts, and what it does is that the gamma radiation that is not aligned with the role of the force is simply lost. So it's as an attenuator, but those who are parallel go further, the photomultiplier. But a photomultiplier is being done in several ways because right now what is happening is the photomultiplier has a crystal. Sodium iodide crystal is the most common one, and that gamma that comes to sodium iodide crystal creates explosions, micro explosions of the visible light. Now those explosions are being seen by a photomultiplier. From the other side of the photomultiplier, you have a phosphor screen. And the phosphor screen is giving a reverse picture of what comes from the gamma radiation. And then you could have a CCD camera, regular CCD camera, or you could have a much clever way. Position sensitive read. How do they do it? They put a hundred of photodiodes and make it read like a pixel in the TV screen. And now, whichever one of the photodiodes is being receiving the light, then that is giving the information. Now you have a special information giving you pretty accurate and much better contrast than the screen of high definition TV only. The colors are not artificial. Okay. Now, some of those applications are a little bit different because they don't really have right now for a planar imaging, but they want to have a spatial 3D imaging. So what is happening is the gamma camera either is multiplied to two cameras, or let's say we have one camera, then one camera is having a stage, rotational stage, that is rotating around the specimen, or around the human body, or around the brain. When it's rotating, the gamma, because the gamma goes from everywhere from that body, comes from a genetic memory. And that's how you have those beautiful slices of the brain, and you know what is going over there, and you can find eventually there is a cancer whatsoever, because the camera is moving. The first time, or is done this way. But when we're coming back to the cyclotron, okay, when we're coming back to cyclotron, it is worth to say that cyclotron by itself without giving any radiation at all is now being used in America. So what they do is they have an accelerator, then they have an electromagnetic deflection out. They're letting those accelerated positrons out, and then they call it at the end of it positron spectroscopy or positron therapy. So those positrons or protons, because you have two of them, you could have a proton as well, look inside the body, very shallow to the body, they have a control power of it. And they allow creation of the picture. For those who do not understand the typical picture that was average was the X-ray picture at the beginning of the century. There was that you had an X-ray photon that has to go through the body and go to the photo screen from behind the body. And that was a film, and that film then was developed. So everything is pretty much similar. Right now, the only thing is that we have right now functions of this type, the pickup.
Wes, did you say that more than just student instruction is taking place at Rutgers with their cyclotron? Are they using it for modern day experiments, to your knowledge?
The main purpose of it is to work into X-ray and to use it for modern day experiments. I believe that for the certain period of time there was a safety issue, and at that video that I have included in the email that you got, I should explain all of the safety issues. So they were afraid of, I believe, they were afraid about the legal issue. But now, not any longer. And also, this thing becomes better and better and better. And some of the features, I believe, are pretty much a revelation comparing to what they use in the modern cyclotron right now. Because this thing is being, again, like a ham radio operator, this thing is being also developed and seen by people who have no business other than just curiosity. Now, one good thing about it is, listen guys closely, this thing utilizes alpha 1500 watts and radio amplifier. This thing utilizes 7.08 megahertz ham radio frequency. And I believe that the guy who is running the show is a ham radio operator. That's right here.
Now, is that the frequency that's being applied to those two D half circles that's doing the accelerating? Go ahead.
That is very much correct.
And I think you said how many mega electron volts they're able to get with that cyclotron at Rutgers. And I think there's a definite limit to the size you can build a cyclotron. Does Rutgers have one of the largest cyclotrons that have been produced to date into X-JM, K2RIW?
Okay, I'm doing here. Well, let me make sure that I'm coming through. Okay, as I am. Okay. They have had, till 2006, they had 800 kilohertz on board. Right now, I believe they are in the vicinity of between 5 to 10 mega electron volts. Also, the way to do with that, the investigators are couldn't measure how big magnetic mass is. They investigate as a mutually varying field of magnet pulses, and they have a beautiful stuff over there inside. It looks like a spiral. I don't even know how to explain, but it's beautiful. Also, they developed their own technology to make the buffer screen, because what they do is, when they are still 25 years, you measure the gravity fiber, and it's increasing in diameter, increasing. At certain point, you can observe that through the viewer, but in order for you to see that what is invisible, you better make it visible. And what you do is you smash it over the puzzle screen, which looks like a triangle with one right angle on it. And you're smashing it. And then when you're smashing it, you are able, it's next to the viewer, you are able to see, let me start. Okay. And so they developed, because they were students, so they were burning like crazy their passwords to you. I think they have two passwords. They developed their own technique. And I think that I'm going to try to approach the guy and try to talk to him, because I'm interested. I mean, I'm extremely interested with how he is able to make the basketball screen. Also, they have a number of supporters right now, because the thing became so rare, at the same time so proud, so much pride to the university. So they got a number of supporters right now, they create the live photos from the cyclotron lab updated every 60 seconds. So they have ability to make the videos of cyclotron operation in motion and photography. Also, what else? I'm looking at their webpage, and the webpage is very easy to find. www.phy. F like Sierra. I-E-S. Dot Roger. Dot E-G-U. R-U-T-G-E-R-S. Dot E-G-U. Slash Cyclotron. So again, I repeat for somebody who is interested with it. www.physics.roger.edu/cyclotron. Enter XJS.
The way that cyclotron works, if I remember correctly, is you start off with the material to be accelerated near the center, and as the two D-sized semicircles accelerate the particles in that magnetic field, they move to a larger and larger radius. I'm going to guess the maximum energy you can get out of the cyclotron is a function of how strong is the magnetic field that gives you the curvature, and what's the largest outer diameter. When it exceeds the outer diameter, those particles are no longer inside the machine. And if I understand correctly, imaging takes place by way of a scintillation crystal and a photomultiplier. Is that it, or is it a phosphor screen? Over US, P2LIW.
Yeah, interesting. Well, one cannot live with the other. It means that the phosphor screen that was used for the X-ray before is still in use, which you're going to have at first for the most photomultiplier to be able to see the photomultiplier operating in near infrared than visible and ultraviolet at most. That's what the photomultiplier does. But most of the photomultipliers are made by Hamato, and they are in visible spectral mode, let me say. Now, when you approach 20 nanometers, then you approach the X-ray border. Then you have a soft X-ray, and then you have a hard X-ray. And then you have the next after, and the next after higher than that with the frequency, but more than that with the gamma. And that's the end of the particles that are much less. So we just leave at a photon. And in here, we're dealing with something that is a particle, but it's very much unusual particles, because it was known to us that we had a beta and gamma radiation, I'm sorry, beta and alpha particles. And it was very much historically true till the time when it starts to build a cyclotron. A cyclotron allows to speed up a particle. But in order to speed up the particle, you gotta have to have that particle unstable. But it's not really unstable. Charged. So in order for the atom to charge, you gotta take something or you gotta give something. Most likely you wanna take something. You want to create an ion. And the only way that you can have an ion is if you have a positive or negative. So that would have happened. As far as you said about the start, yes, there is a limitation. Well, the typical law about that is responsible for the action is D equals QBD, what was that, QBTR? No, that was the QBD equal MD squared divided by R. That was a typical the equation that was a time for the class. Let me stop. I don't want to over time for you. One, two, three. Okay, fine. So, talking about the operation, for easier, I'm going to repeat again. You have a sandwich. You have a magnet on the top. You have a magnet at the bottom. The inner face that is facing, that would be inside the sandwich, or that magnet that is on the top, is a south pole. The north, from the other side, is the one that is at the bottom. And then you have something like a pan, like a cook pan. So it's, let's say, 16 inches, 9 inches, 4 inches, whatever you want. And it is covered with the top. And between that top and that pan, you have rubber. You have rubber seal. And when you have a rubber seal, it's sort of hermetic. Now, inside that, you have a 2D. So imagine that you have had a disc, you cut the disc on half, it's horizontal, it's inside the pan, and now you create a 2D. There is a, however, important information. The 2D has to be charged. So the 2D has to be isolated from the pan. One could be negative, one could be positive, at a fraction of time. So actually what you're doing is you're changing the polarity. Left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. That's one of the ways to do it. Now, in the middle of it, I have explained to John, and John would be able to explain how that that block with the iron source looks like. John, are you able to talk now?
Well, he told me, I have not seen the video, they have an element that runs down the center of the 2Ds, bisecting that, and it heats up. It's thermal, and it has a coating on it, and I believe that's what helps it, what he told me.
I think we have another station for
this. Is there another station that wants to join us? T2RIW in the TechNet. Wes, are the machines, these accelerators you're now describing, this is something I don't know, have they ever been used to generate the materials that have the short half-life that are used for nuclear medicine test procedures? Have these machines ever been used to generate those materials into XJN, K2LAW?
Yes. Actually, 97% of all medical supplies of the radioactive material is made by Cephalstone. And there are few, before they have been doing that in the nuclear power station. And that was one of the ways of making them if possible. They also have a certain improvement and implementation. But then, because the technology became so inexpensive, the amateur who has built his own first cyclotron at his basement estimates that the cost of doing it is $125,000, including the labor per fact. It's not true. Because as ham radio operators in Europe, the same way the guys who were fascinating with it could have it for very, very little money. And that's how he did it. He spent $2 only for it. He was lucky that the magnets were available for him because they were made for similar purpose. And that's why he chosen to go to a Nobel Prize ceremony, and it was paid, all of the cost was paid for him because he was so unusually able to do it. And right now I estimate that we have a huge number of the people who are sent for it, at least 2020 cyclotron amateur made in the United States of America, the field.
You didn't answer your question, Dick. Maybe you try again.
I get the impression that some of the nuclear medicine raw materials are being produced this way. I think you did say that 90-some-odd% of them are produced that way. It seems to me also that in the case of a cyclotron, the maximum energy you can get out of a particle is a function of how strong is the magnetic field, and how large is the outer diameter of the cyclotron. With modern materials, you can make much stronger magnets than you have in the past. I think that suggests that some of the cyclotrons they built in the past could be upgraded with better magnets and therefore produce a higher amount of power output. I wonder if that has taken place, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm trying right now, N2XJN. I'm trying right now to find that material that states about the production of nuclear medical materials for medical use. I found actually the material about the guy who is Fred Neil, F-R-E-D, N-I-E-L, L, double L. He built the cyclotron as high school student, and he won the grand prize of International Science and Engineering Fair. Trip to Sweden to see Nobel Prize proceedings in Swedish Academy of Science, and he was able to dance with the Princess Victoria. So that was the beauty of it. There is another guy who had atomic basement, and this guy is Olsen. I'm trying to Chris Olsen. Chris Olsen, O-L-S-E-N, and he made 8 centimeter diameter at first, but he made then 6 feet in diameter in British Columbia campus in Vancouver. So the guy, he looks like a young boy, and he's a doctoral student, I believe, trying to get to the part. Okay, cyclotron is the type of particle accelerator in which charged particles accelerate outwards from the center along the spiral path. I'm reading right now. The particles are held into a spiral trajectory by a static magnetic field and accelerated by rapidly varying radio frequency electricity. What actually struck me, we have in Newark, just around the border, we have working device on the frequency of ham radio, built by people from scratch as a private initiative for many. What I am pointing at, that was the way that I was raised. That was the rage in communist times in the country, how I was raised. That was the value that I never met in the U.S. And now I see it. I'm very clear.
Are you considering building one of these machines, Wes? You've collected quite a bit of material over the years. You sound like you're interested enough to build one. Also, that student who built one and won a prize, do we know how big was his machine over the U.S., K2LIW?
Yeah, that was the guy, hold on, let me go to that part. I believe 12 inches. I believe 12 inches that was... Well, my interest with that started when I saw the beam of electrons moving in the circle. And that was by the occupation of the gas atoms in a hole. Now, when you take, at first when I purchased my vacuum chamber, which was actually close to no money spent, yes, I spent for the travel to North Carolina. I met a very nice person, and you know, the chef, as long as I'm not going to be scrapped, I'm happy with it. Then I said to myself, hey, what do I do with it? I'm dealing with Coleman, every check Coleman is in a vacuum. And then I said to myself, okay, I could use it for a Holmes coil and see that beautiful loop of the electrons. And then I was trying to prove something that actually contradicts Dick's opinion would be... And that would be that they said that HF and VHF radio frequency does not interact with the matter, to the
point of breaking nuclear mass. Would I say that I very close to true is not true? Of course I might be mistaken, but I say it's not true. It is breaking. So what I'm saying is I was trying to see that we're dealing with Coleman. I was trying to see what is a similarity between a cyclotron and Coleman. Coleman has a tube with non-radioactive contents, and it does actually to electromagnets, but doesn't have a vacuum. And then I came into the cyclotron when, after you have a vacuum, you're introducing hydrogen. You can introduce anything you want. You can have also in that vacuum a plutonium, and you can accelerate plutonium. What is beautiful about it, you can do whatever you want with it. You're never going to build a nuclear weapon, but you are able to spin up the particles. And the funny thing about it, you don't have a radioactivity, only if you don't smash. So all of that medical supply is created by smashing. When you don't smash, you have a movement, but you don't have a radiation. Enter the gear. Let me go for it. Okay, so, and when you have that spiral, in order for you to have any use of the particles that you feed up, you have to have a nozzle, and that nozzle is on the outer edge of the cyclotron, and you use an electromagnetic deflection. And why is electromagnetic deflection? Because you're dealing with particles with mass, moving mass. So when I said to myself, okay, if we don't have a vacuum, but we have those two very worldly, very weird shapes, electromagnets in Coleman patterns, my fuel stop very much the need to put it in the magnet, exactly that shape. It didn't put the straight edge, it put very much curvy edge, like a part of the circle. Because at first I thought that the beta particles are the electromagnetic field such as a dispersive factor. So it just put it there. And then I was getting deeper into the lenses for the gamma radiation and X-ray radiation. And I find out that it's quite different from the optical one. So actually what is happening is it's taking whatever the particles are coming out of it, activated by 300 to 400 megahertz radio frequency, which is of course not yet true. And then it's redirecting to the end of the tube. When it's redirecting to the end of the tube, now you have a different part of the tube interacting. And then if we would be able to apply the so-called motion to it, maybe this is what I'm looking for, free energy. Energy would not be really free, it would be free from charge. In other words, being able to take the energy from matter, or from any form of that, or from the reservoir of that, and convert it to the electrical energy, but without need to pay for it. So, am I trying to build it? No, I am not. I don't have the time for all of that, but one of the things that I bought, $100, and I was talking to John about, $100, one micro lux sensitivity microscope that is working with very, very ultralight, and it's based on very special camera. Enter
here. I think you're now describing your electron microscope. Is that true, Wes? Go ahead.
I've got recently two devices. One of them is a micro-emitter. Micro-emitter has a circular stage that has a four glass like the regular microscope has, and
it is able to turn that turntable to one of the four positions, but also is able to put the table up and down. And everything is in dark, closed chamber. The device is not a very deep one. Now, the camera doesn't have a motorized lens at all. It is the camera that is based on for the multiplier and whatsoever. And the table actually makes the focus. This thing has a sensitivity of 1 microflux. So we say that a typical camera used to be 1 lux. Then 0.1 microflux was extremely good one. Then they say, well, it's less than 1 lux, which was actually not true because they were using the infrared LED, so there was never anything that was below zero, and it would never be. But this thing by itself is a 1 microflux. That's extremely, extremely low. It could not be exposed to the visible light when it's connected, but I'm working right now on it and trying to make it work. And I say, I don't know how, the new one is $70,000, I'll tell you where it's at. I've got it for $100. That's what it is.
Concerning your earlier discussion as to whether or not RF energy can create a nuclear reaction, in the case of a cyclotron, I'm going to believe it. RF energy accelerating the particles to a high enough energy level and then colliding them with something, that can be a nuclear reaction, I think. But in the case of putting chemistry into a couple of millimeter diameter quartz piece of tubing and subjecting that to RF energy where no acceleration takes place, I'm fairly skeptical, even though there's a patent on that subject, that that might not be a nuclear reaction. And because of the presence of the RF energy in your body, you've got to be very careful that your Geiger counter or scintillation counter is not responding to the RF and giving you an indication of a nuclear reaction, which might not be real. Over to you, Wes, KQLIW.
Oh, yes. Indeed, I agree with you. So let's say, because it's impossible, it's not going to happen. And that's what I have seen. It was an illusion because my Geiger meter was pulled out from the earth. Oh, yeah. The only thing is that then what you do is if you say that what you see is not necessarily what is happening, now you're using a different kind of tool that will allow you to see better. And right now I have a different kind of environment that I can check it out. I have a position sensitive photo multiplier with a very much special crystal on it, and number of collimators. One collimator only, $18,000. One collimator only. I've got five of them, for free. When you look for it, you get it. Because people got it. What do I need it for? Honeycomb? Okay? So, if I don't have the results, fine, nothing's gonna happen. You're just gonna be listening to me because I love science and I'm gonna be in the science. But nothing's gonna happen. What if I would be able to prove it undeniably, beyond the reasonable doubt, that RF frequency is breaking the nuclear bond? What would then happen? Just a theoretical question.
Yeah, this is one of those cases where you've got to try everything you can to make sure you've removed all of the doubts of all the mechanisms that can give a false indication. In the case of your position-sensitive photo-multiplier detector, I think that position-sensitive collimator that's out in front looks like a honeycomb. It's a bunch of thin, long pieces of tubing that only will allow particles to flow in a particular direction into the scintillator and then into the photomultiplier, this is my guess. And I think you're saying you own a number of those collimators. Do they build different collimators with different size honeycomb, with different lengths? What's different about the number of collimators that you own now, Wes? N2XJN, KQIW?
Before I go to that, let me start from a photon emitter, which would be the device that I said that I have. It's the same manufacturer, it's the French manufacturer. They stopped the grid because it was too expensive. And everything collapsed in 2008. The photon emitter is the dynamic modular system that has a non-invasive detection, a localization, and quantification of dynamic optical signal to luminescence, fluorescence, and reading right now. There is a very much developed photon counting technology that makes it extremely sensitive from very fast image acquisition and enable unparalleled kinetic recording of dynamic processes without the need of setting acquisition time. So that's how this thing works. It uses the very much sensitive CCD camera, and then what is happening is if you want to see a visible light, you'll be able to magnify it to 1 micrometer. But if you want to, so you can magnify the visible light to 1 micrometer. But if you want to see gamma or beta or any kind of radiation, they say you got to put between the camera objective and the specimen you got to put in for you, the centering for you. So now when I come back to the gamma a camera, which is a position sensitive photo multiplier, let me draw. Now, the only difference is that this thing doesn't need any scintillating foil. It does have a crystal. So I have a number of the honeycomb with hundreds of poles, a collimator. Now what a collimator does is trading out the gamma radiation. So the gamma could work also with the X-ray as well. If it comes from the bottom, the gamma ray is not parallel, it's not going to go through. It's going to drop. So we're talking about attenuation. But when it comes to the crystal, there is right about that, it then triggers an explosion. Hundreds, thousands of an explosion for each hole where the gamma goes through. Now, the more narrow you have the honeycomb, and that's why it's so expensive, that the collimator is more expensive than the camera by itself, because it's hard to do it. Especially when the collimator doesn't have a circular hole, but it has a hexagonal hole. Right, that's what I have. All of them are hexagonal. They simply were better. So the more narrow, the more holes you have, the more accurate pixels you have. And then, this picture comes to the crystal, from crystal to the photomultiplier. And photomultiplier, at the end of it, at the very top of it, has a phosphor screen. Now on that phosphor screen, you have inverse image of all the thousands of holes. And to make it even more sharp, high definition TV, what they do is they put rows of photodiodes. Each photodiode is responsible for 1 pixel. And each photodiode is connected then, or not directly to the grid, but to the very short piece of fiber optic. The fiber optic actually delivers very much collimated, very much straightened out the image of the explosion to get AV. Now, what you have is, actually you have a picture of what's going on. You see a spinal column, or you can see anything you want. You can see a very much ideal structure, and then when you try to rotate the camera,
then you're getting a tridimensional image. All you need is just to memorize the particle position. Usually it's one rotation per minute and to X-ray.
WA2SVM disconnected. W2KPQ.
Okay, we've only got about a minute or two left. An interesting science takes place with all this apparatus. I've never owned a photomultiplier. Someday I'm going to have to get one of those. Low-light camera. I'd love to have a low-light camera connected to my telescope for astrophotography. That can be a lot of fun. I don't think you've ever put a low-light camera on your telescope, John. Can I pass it up for some final comments, because we're about to run out of time, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. No, Dick, that's one thing I never... I work with a lot of different types of film and different ASA and DISA numbers, but no electronic cameras. They weren't there when I was doing it. They were pretty ugly with those Vidicons. But don't forget, Wesley's experiment, one thing you forgot to mention, the Geiger counter kept reading for up to a half hour after he disconnected all of the power from the Colvin device. He was detecting radiation from the Colvin tube up for a half an hour. So just thought I'd remind you of that. So it doesn't matter what instrumentation he's using to test it, the Ranger or whatever kind of junk or good stuff, doesn't matter. Geiger counter was still reading. That's unexplainable to me anyway. I keep Dick, and I want to thank everybody for joining the net. As tough as it is, in fact. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the electronics connected to a Geiger counter could be getting subjected to the RF energy, which creates some drift, heating and drift, and that heating and drift could take a significant period of time in order to go back to quiescent case condition. So I still think some form of experiment has to be created to make sure that drift of the electronics, because I presume it's the equivalent of a DC amplifier, and high gain DC amplifiers are subjected to drift. That is a slim possibility. I wonder if you consider that, John. Back to you, John. K2LIW.
Yes, I have, Dick. To return to quiescent state, you're absolutely right. It can take a lot of time. I have a few DC amplifiers, and I've experienced that, and it was quite a while before they would settle back down again, depending on the input that went to. But yeah, there's a lot of different things that have to be looked at. That's why I told Wes, you got to make sure and just be very prudent with his technical information as he writes it all down, and so he can recreate it at any time. Back to you, Dick.
There is a kind of a DC amplifier that does negate a lot of the drift. It's called chopper. If you do the equivalent of synchronous demodulation, in other words, let me pick a number, 400 times per second or 1,000 times per second, you reverse the polarity going into the amplifier. And now you look at the amplitude of the chopped signal and polarity of the chopped signal. That allows you, with synchronous demodulation, to measure very low DC voltages, and it basically gets rid of the drift. A automatic noise figure indicator works that way, and there's another piece of electronics, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, that also uses that technique. I wonder if you've ever heard of that one, John, K2LIW.
Yes, I have, Dick. It was described as jogging, like you would jog a motor. They do the same thing for the amplifiers, which gives you a zero balance reference in the cancellation.
Yeah, that technique can get rid of a lot of the drift, almost all of it. Stone bridge, chopper stabilized, synchronous demodulating. You put those things together, and now you can build very high gain amplifier, DC amplifier, and have almost no drift, because the amplifier is continuously running on a square wave that's essentially an AC signal. And it's only the magnitude of the AC signal and the polarity of the AC signal with reference to the polarity switcher that tells you whether or not there's a positive or negative voltage there.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the
W2VL repeater. Yeah, yeah.
Very good, very good. And, well, you're pretty far along your trip already, so if you're on the FTR already. And, yeah, it was a quiet weekend, not too much going on, and, so, I got together with a former, social studies teacher, from my high school. We hadn't seen him in a few months, so got together with him and another friend and went out to dinner, in Glen Cove, Saturday night, had a nice time. And, yeah, it's been very quiet. I've been listening on the repeater, and, because I had to get through the, know that Oyster Bay area. But I haven't heard anybody on at all until you called in. So I don't know what Lou's doing and everybody else this morning. Hopefully the link is up and working as I get more eastward. W2SC T-Mobile.
KC2KKX. Pete, I'm about to go under... Crazy Mansion, so give me 2 minutes to come out the other end.
No problem. I'll make a transmission and hopefully you'll hear it pretty well. Yeah, the Crazy Mansion, I guess it's really quite a... the fact that they built it right over the FTR, I guess they built the FTR under Crazy Mansion because it was there long before the FTR. I'll have to look up the history of that, but... yeah, I haven't driven through there in quite a number of years. I haven't been on the FDR and drive in probably 20 plus years or more. And, very good. Yeah, looking forward to, my, time in Mexico and, getting to, Puerto Vallarta. That we're all set for this coming Saturday, and have to fly through Minneapolis, St. Paul, though, because of the, I kind of waited, and it was a little bit hard to get the nonstop fares as low as I could going through another city, so I'll be staying over each way going and coming. Back to you.
Sounds like a good break from the weather in New York. And hopefully the weather in the Midwest won't interfere with your connection. And don't forget to bring back some warm air when you come back.
Yeah, I'm hoping that I'll be able to do that. Much as possible, and and I just hope I, because I'm flying into the lion's den of winter weather going through Minneapolis, but hopefully there won't be any issues with that, and we'll be okay. But yeah, just staying overnight on next Saturday, and then coming back the following Saturday, and staying overnight so I get back here Sunday. So it should be good. It should all work out pretty well. W2SCT Mobile.
Very good, Pete. You got time to do any HF over the weekend or in the car or not so much?
Not really. I didn't work any HF. No, I didn't work any out of the car. And, so I don't know if how were the bands, if you got on there, how were the bands over the weekend? I know we're getting close to the couple of contests coming up on the HF there. The DX series, I think, it's usually around this time of year. Comes up maybe a little later this month than early March. And I'm going to bring my HT, but I haven't, I don't know what kind of 2-meter operation is in Puerto Vallarta. I'll have to check that out a little bit. But, you know, I'm so busy on vacation that I really don't tend to have the time, because we'll be with a group of us staying in two different homes, so we'll have a lot of different things that we'll be planning out. Back to you, Pete.
Yeah,